Podcasts for PRI's The World are made possible in part by the generous support of our donors. Visit PRI.org/give and ensure that outstanding global programming continues. After all, it's your world. Jump in.
More prisoners walk free in Russia. Today, December 23rd, this is The World. I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman. Two more critics of Russian President Vladimir Putin are released from prison, and they immediately criticized Putin's move as a PR stunt. Meanwhile, some Russians have the opposite view of their leader.
I think he can be criticized for lots of things. You know, you may be surprised, but I think he's too liberal.
Also today, remembering a famous, some would say infamous, Colombian accordion player.
Kids, rather than growing up and wanting to be a rock star, they'll want to be an accordion hero and emulate Diomedes Diaz.
Plus, think twice before you pour bad rum into your eggnog. Rum Agricole from Martinique is the way to go. That's all coming up today on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. In Russia, this week started right where the last one left off, with the release of high-profile prisoners. Last week, it was Mikhail Khodorkovsky, once a powerful critic of President Vladimir Putin. Today, two members of the protest punk band Pussy Riot walked free. They'd been in jail for most of the past 2 years, convicted of hooliganism after holding an anti-Putin protest inside a cathedral. After their release, the women criticized Putin's decision to grant them amnesty, calling it a PR stunt.
This is just a show ahead of the Olympics. They want to prevent a boycott of the Russian Winter Olympics. But let's remember all those people who are still in Russian jails, forgotten, but they don't belong there.
That was Nadezhda Tolokonikova shortly after walking out of her Siberian prison. But Putin and his government have their supporters, too. Dmitry Babich is a political analyst for the state-run radio station Voice of Russia. He points out that the members of Pussy Riot were also doing a PR stunt at the time they were arrested.
I think it was not political in the beginning. Primarily, it was aimed just at attracting attention and making Christians in Russia angry because they performed that so-called song inside the altar of the church and they called the patriarch, the head of Orthodox Church, a bitch. In that song. So it was primarily anti-religious. Later on, when the hammer started to come to the anvil and there was a criminal case, the Western media framed them as political protesters and they tried to fit that image.
But that kind of provocation certainly didn't warrant a prison sentence.
I think that they should have been condemned. There should have been a verdict. And I'm glad that it was just hooliganism, because if they tried to attract any kind of political stuff here, like insulting religious feelings, that would be very difficult to prove with the kind of professional attorneys that the Pussy Riot members had. But certainly, I think the verdict was just they did some very bad things. As for Khodorkovsky, I think it's a different matter, because it was not part of this amnesty, which released not only Pussy Riot members, but also thousands of other people kept in jail. It was just a decision of the president. The Russian president, just like the American one, has the right to pardon people in jail. And with Khodorkovsky, I think that it was just a miscalculation on the part of the West. It was the right calculation on the part of Putin, miscalculation on the part of the West.
What do you mean by that?
I think that the West convinced itself that Khodorkovsky is a politician. For all of these 10 years, we have been reading in the Western press that he is a powerful man, that he has convictions. Putin is afraid of him. He could be a very good candidate at presidential election. And I'm not sure that's the case, because Khodorkovsky never won any elections. He was never a politician. He was always that kind of oligarchic businessman of the Russian 90s.
Vladimir Putin has made these gestures. One is to release Khodorkovsky. Another is this amnesty, which affects a number of people, including the members of Pussy Riot. But he's sort of not getting much love from the Western press even after that. Why do you think that is?
Well, because the Western press is extremely inobjective. It creates the reality that it wants to see. It's more about show business now than about press, because the real press is about fighting stereotypes and telling the truth. And the Western press is about confirming stereotypes that people have in their minds, not only about Russia, but about a number of other things.
Let's go to our respective business, which is media and news. You know, a respected news agency in Russia, RIA Novosti, just got shut down. Is there a sense among any Russians that Putin is getting too powerful?
He has his limitations, just like any modern politician. One of the problems with him is he's extremely unpopular in the West. And this is something that makes our elite sort of sad. This creates for him a lot of enemies inside Russia. But it's not because I like Putin too much. I think he can be criticized for lots of things. You know, you may be surprised, but I think he's too liberal. He introduced a lot of liberal solutions in Russian economy, which just destroyed whole industries. And that made him unpopular with the people. But the West doesn't listen to the Russian people. It only listens to the people it wants to listen to. You know, this small circle of liberal opposition, which considers Khodorkovsky a hero and Pussy Riot members artists.
That was Dmitry Babich, political analyst for the state-run Voice of Russia radio station. Mikhail Khodorkovsky flew to Germany after his release last week. Yesterday, he granted an hour-long interview to Russian-speaking journalists. Allison Smale of the New York Times was there and got to see the former oil tycoon up close.
He looks physically very well. Obviously, he has a fairly good constitution. And he also made a point of emphasizing that yes, Russian prison is certainly no picnic, but that really this is not the gulag of the Soviet era literature that we have all read.
Did he say how prison affected him? I mean, were there any big lessons learned by spending all that time there?
There was one passage where he said that he had learned truly that the most important thing in life is other people. The biggest loss, he said, of the past 10 years is 10 lost years of communication with his family. And he also waxed eloquent about how once he had seen value in industrial possessions, but that now he knows it's human beings that are above all important.
Now, he was the richest man in Russia before he went to prison. Not so anymore. Does Khodorkovsky have any money left?
He said yesterday that he honestly doesn't know actually what his financial state is, but what he did say was that it's certainly enough to live on, he said with a little smile.
Did he give any sign that he's going to try to get back any wealth that he lost?
He made very clear that when he wrote a letter to Vladimir Putin at the suggestion of the former German foreign minister, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, that he had made clear he would not engage in day-to-day politics because, he said, he's not interested in the fight for power in that sense. He also made clear that he wouldn't be trying to get back his shares of his company that are now part of a company called Rosneft, headed by a Putin ally, Igor Sechin.
Now, you mentioned Hans-Dietrich Genscher, the former German foreign minister who played a key role in getting Khodorkovsky released. What was the German interest in this, and how did it get started?
Well, I think the German interest is just the broad German interest. Certainly, the Kremlin doesn't have ties with any other country quite the way it has ties with Germany. These are the two powers of Central and Eastern Europe. They have over the centuries been friends, they've been enemies, but what they always are near neighbors. They've been trading partners for forever, and it's always something that is very important for the leader of each country to be seen to be having good ties with the leadership of the other country.
I guess my final question is Khodorkovsky going to stay in Germany, and is his family there with him? Is this now his new home?
I think it's absolutely unclear, frankly. He clearly could stay here, but this was a man who, when we spoke, had spent, you know, not even 48 hours in freedom after 10 years in Russian prisons and being tried in Russian courts. So I think it's not surprising if perhaps he hasn't made up his mind about anything, or if he has made up his mind, that he's not letting other people know before he really has a chance to reconnect with his nearest and dearest.
Alison Smail is the Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. Alison, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sé que no gustas de mí, pero yo soy feliz, no más con tu desprecio.
His traditional songs will live on, but the king of Colombian vallenato folk music died yesterday. Diomedes Diaz will be remembered in Colombia for his accordion-laced tunes, but also for his larger-than-life personality and his criminal record. Reporter John Otis is in Bogota, Colombia. And John, if you walk down the street and ask a Colombian who Diomedes Diaz is, will that person be able to answer you?
Sure. Everybody knows who he is. And for most people, what he was a terrific singer, a terrific crooner, but not such a great person on the personal level.
Now, I understand he has quite the criminal record. How did he get into trouble?
Diomedes Diaz sort of led the rock star cliche life. He was into drugs and booze. He had a girlfriend who he apparently strangled and left out in a cow pasture. He was convicted for manslaughter for that.
When was this?
This was back in the late 90s. And after he was convicted, rather than turning himself in, he went up into the mountains to hide, and he was protected by paramilitary death squads who were big fans of his, so they were happy to protect him because he was like their idol. And then when he finally turned himself in, the guards were so in awe of him, he was such a big star, that they let him install all this recording equipment in his prison cell, and he recorded 3 CDs for Sony Music while in prison.
Wow. And he was able to sell them? They released them, and he was able to reap profits from it?
Yeah, he was able to continue his career. And for every day he recorded music in his jail cell, he got 2 days reduced from his pretty short prison sentence to begin with. And so he got out of jail after just a couple of years, and then he launched this huge comeback tour, filling up stadiums in Bogota and other cities, and just sort of went on his way as this big star, and everybody seemed to forgive him.
Really? So did his music change at all during his prison term?
Not really. He did a few reflective songs, but he never really repented. He had one song where he said, you know, I feel like I deserve another chance because I've also done a lot of good deeds. So he never really came out and said he was sorry for this crime.
What is it about his music that people love so much?
You know, Carol, vallenato music is Colombian folk music from the northern coast, from the Valledupar region. And the main feature is the accordion. And the squeeze box is just such a great party instrument. You add an accordion to almost any kind of music and it makes it danceable. And the lyrics talk about love and life out in the Colombian countryside. And he's got Diomedes has this very distinctive voice, and he's just instantly recognizable. And he's been the soundtrack for so many Colombians for so long. He's been recording music for about 30 years, and he's just an icon here. And so today everybody's in mourning that he's dead, but you know, I'm not so sure that he's looking down on us from heaven, so to speak.
Are there younger musicians who emulate his music?
Diomedes Diaz was, he was an icon, and he was also a role model for a lot of new generation vallenato singers like Carlos Vives. Vallenato music will live on without Diomedes Diaz. There's a lot of younger guys coming up in Diomedes' footsteps, and most of the new guys have managed to stay on the right side of the law.
I was going to say that he's a role model for music, but not necessarily lifestyle.
Exactly. I mean, this guy... It completely was a double life. You can hear his music every day on the radio, especially if you're up in northern Colombia in Valledupar. That's the cradle of vallenato music, and that it's just king. You'll hear it everywhere. And kids, rather than growing up and wanting to be a rock star, they'll want to be an accordion hero and play vallenato music and emulate Diomedes Diaz.
John Otis in Bogota, Colombia. Thanks so much, John.
Okay, thanks a lot, Carol.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. It's hard to fathom, but after World War II, some Jewish survivors of the Holocaust decided to stay in, and in some cases, move to Germany. They settled in what was Communist East Germany, or the GDR. Now, a new German play addresses a part of that history. It's called Muttersprache Mamelotchen. And it's been a sensation on the Berlin stage. The play recently had a small run of staged readings in the U.S. The World's Carol Zoll went to one of the performances and spoke with the playwright, Mariana Salzmann.
When Mariana Salzmann decided to write a play about the Jewish experience in East Germany, she wanted to work out some issues that she herself was grappling with.
I was just looking for my roots, and the play was a way to find out about that and looking for answers for all my questions towards Jewishness.
Salzmann moved from Russia to Germany in 1995 when she was still a child. Her play, which is set in modern-day Germany, portrays three generations of Jewish women.
Was hast du getan?
Ich habe so getan, als hätte ich's nicht gemerkt.
Du bist eine kluge Tochter.
There's Lynn, a Holocaust survivor who's had a career as a Yiddish folk singer, her assimilated daughter, who wants nothing to do with Jewish culture, and her granddaughter, who's curious about her heritage but knows little about it. In a sense, she's Salzmann's alter ego.
I was not expecting to have like a big audience for this play. I thought it's kind of like, for me, my dealing with certain issues.
But the tale struck a chord with German audiences. Salzmann, who's only 28, won a major award for it.
It was a topic that actually not many people are dealing with.
Detlef Gericke Schönagen directs Boston's Goethe Institute, which brought the play to the U.S. for a brief run. He says Germans know very little about this part of their history.
What was the life of Jews in the former GDR? There are not many books about it, not many articles about it.
The play's most compelling character is the grandmother, who's loosely based on a real-life folk singer, Lynn Yaldati. She was one of a small number of Jewish survivors who settled in communist East Germany after the war. Salzmann says they wanted to help build an anti-fascist state there.
There was a group of very political Holocaust survivors who said, no, we're staying on our ground and we will recreate it. We will not give Germany up.
But as the play makes clear, the GDR didn't turn into the classless society they'd hoped for, and Jewish East Germans often faced discrimination and anti-Semitism.
And it was very, very tragic for Holocaust survivors who kind of like lived the history again. I don't want to compare those two stories, but for them it was kind of like a non-ending story with Germany and with the German state.
But the play is a personal story, too. It's about mothers and daughters. The title makes that clear.
I was so fascinated by the word mother tongue, Mamelotchen, and I thought it's good for Germans to know a little bit of Yiddish. I think like we have to bring it back. And in German, Muttersprache is like the language of the mothers. And the play is about the language of the mothers. You got the grandmother talking to her daughter and the mother talking to her daughter. And everybody misunderstands each other, loves each other like crazy, but there's no way of communication.
While the characters struggle to communicate, German audiences seem to get the message. And for Mariana Salzmann, that success on the German stage for a play about a Jewish family has been gratifying. But she says there are changes in Germany that aren't so reassuring. Salzmann says that anti-Semitism is creeping back in.
If your ears are open, you realize that, for example, Jew is again an offensive word in schools. Like, I grew up and I was always the privileged migrant in school. And everybody loved me for the reason that I am Jewish. My brother, who is 10 years younger than me, he suffered a lot for being Jewish. And that's where I realized, oh, this country is changing.
Salzmann says that by writing about the concerns of Jews in Germany today, she's trying to change things, too.
I think it's a little bit bringing back the Jewish culture to a certain normal state, not exotic anymore, not, oh, Holocaust, but, oh, okay, this is a part of our culture and our country.
For The World, I'm Carol Zoll.
This is the time of year when dictionaries and linguists all over the globe issue their words of the year. The World's language editor, Patrick Cox, is here. And Patrick, there have been several choices this year, but the one that seems to have really captured the global imagination is selfie.
Yeah, that's right, Carol. And you know, it's a word that's captured more than just the English-speaking public. The big moment, of course, was, you know, that snapshot that was taken at Nelson Mandela's memorial featuring Barack Obama, Prime Minister David Cameron of Britain, and taken by the Danish Prime Minister Helle Thorning-Schmidt. After that, there was absolutely no escaping the word selfie.
So, Patrick, I assume the Danes debated themselves whether it was okay for their prime minister to take a picture like that, a selfie, at a memorial service for Nelson Mandela, no less. So when all that was going on, what word did they use for selfie?
Well, two things on that. First, the Danes, they didn't really have the kind of debate that took place in this country. They were generally not upset at the idea of a picture like this being taken. As for the word selfie in Danish, well, here's the answer.
We stole your word for it. We also call it a selfie.
That is Carl Erik Stogård. He's with the Danish newspaper Politiken. And, you know, Danish isn't alone here. In fact, I haven't been able to find a single language that has a word for selfie that isn't the English word selfie. The word itself, possibly with roots in Australian English, is gone global in such a short time, but really a linguistic nanosecond, that other languages just, they haven't had time to react. It's like the word is there, the hashtag is there, you better get used to it. And if you don't use it, well, you're just not going to be a part of the conversation.
Okay, so we don't know of any alternatives to selfie, but if any of our listeners do, please let us know. If you've come across any word for selfie in any other language, you can post your answers at pri.org/language. And by the way, Patrick, do you have a word of the year yourself?
Actually, I do. I don't normally do this because I think it gets so much publicity elsewhere and people are very good at doing this. But this year, I came across the word styly, S-T-Y-L-Y. And I love this word because it's something of a linguistic orphan. This is what the kids are saying in France, you know, meaning stylish. C'est stylé, huh?
Wow.
And, you know, it's a bastardization of an English term. But the thing is, the French, they don't want it. There's a member of the Académie Française, the guardians of the French language. He complained about his son using the term. He called it ridiculous. And, well, ridiculous or not, it's being used. I can't resist making it my word of the year.
Okay, Patrick, thanks so much for being with us.
You're very welcome, Carol.
And we have some political cartoons from around the world featuring imagined selfie shots. Just go to pri.org/language. Coming up a bit later in the show, forget all about industrial rum made from molasses.
What we think of as rum today is not really reflective of what it can be. It can be pretty spectacular.
And where does some of the most spectacular rum come from? Stay tuned. I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, the designer of the ubiquitous AK-47 assault rifle has died. Mikhail Kalashnikov blamed politicians for the wars that featured his deadly invention.
However, he also has said that he would have preferred to make agricultural machinery, and he says, I always wanted to work on a good lawnmower.
That and more ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, recognizing the important role of their healthcare partners in helping improve the lives of more than 9 million people around the world last year. Learn more at Medtronic.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. In Egypt, the hope was that the Arab Spring would usher in a new era of democracy. But it's not looking good on that front. Over the weekend, an Egyptian court sentenced three prominent pro-democracy activists to 3 years in prison. The verdict has sparked fears that Egypt is sliding back toward the same kind of repression that was common before the revolution. To get the latest on that and also look back at Egypt in 2013, we turn to the Financial Times' Borzu Daragahi. First, Borzu, tell me who these activists are and why they were sentenced.
Well, the most famous of them is Ahmed Maher. All three of them were co-founders of a movement called the April 6th Movement. This was launched in 2008 out of a labor strike that took place in the Nile Delta town of Mahalla. And from this movement, they created this type of activism, this type of peaceful, non-ideological political activism that ultimately led to the 2011 revolution. It could be said that these people were some of the pillars of the 2011 uprising against Hosni Mubarak.
Now, they were each sentenced to 3 years in prison. What does this mean, that they were given these three-year sentences? And what exactly are they being accused of?
You know, I got to say, it's kind of absurd. They were accused of organizing and participating in demonstrations that were not authorized. If you think about that, something like that in New York City, will, you know, it's probably a misdemeanor fine that you pay. Maybe you spend a couple days in lockup taking part in a demonstration that didn't have a police permit. It's not that big of a deal. And these guys got a three-year sentence. In addition to that, you know, we're talking about a legal system that sometimes takes up to 10 years to resolve a civil case, that takes years and years to prosecute anyone. And somehow, when it comes to these three activists, these courts become a model of efficiency and sentence these guys a month after they've been arrested. So it's a, you know, what many would consider a gross miscarriage of justice here.
Now, what I read was that the law that they were convicted of is in fact a law that was created after Mohamed Morsi was overthrown in the coup. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. This is what many people see as an attempt by the military to consolidate its control. I think many people also consider it ironic. This interim government, came to power because of a series of unauthorized illegal protests, so to speak. And then they move to legislate protests so that no more can happen. Many people see irony in that.
Now, I mean, let's look back over the entire year. I mean, how would you sum up the events, really, in a nutshell, in Egypt during 2013?
Well, I think a lot happened over the last year. I think in the end, what you're going to get out of the last year, what historians and political scientists will look at, is the way the Egyptian elite, the intelligentsia, faced with the prospect of an imperfect, flawed democratic process dominated by political Islamists, instead went back into the arms of the deep state and embraced them.
And when you say Egyptian liberals, are you talking about the people in the interim government, or are you talking about the secularist liberals who initially embraced the coup against Morsi and thought, we need this sort of military government?
When you talk about Egyptian liberals, we're talking about the secularists to a large extent. You're talking about, for example, the Social Democratic Party. You're talking about more educated, wealthy elites who did well under Mubarak, but you know, have connections to the West, and so said that they aspired to Western values and paid lip service to the democracy and human rights. When it came down to it, they ultimately didn't support it because they were on the losing side of democracy.
So where does it leave Egypt at this point?
There was a really insightful editorial in the New York Times today about how things couldn't look any bleaker right now for Egypt. I think politically speaking, it's becoming somewhat of a backwater again, whereas once it was a sort of inspirational role model for democratic aspiring people around the region and around the world. Now it seems to be a people turning inward, and you know, that's never an exciting story to cover. It's never an inspiring narrative.
The Financial Times, Borzu Daragahi. Thanks so much, Borzu.
It's been a pleasure.
When you think of Latinos and religion, it's Catholicism. But more and more Latino Americans are converting to Islam. It's hard to get a precise figure, but there may be as many as 100,000 Latino Muslims living in the U.S. today. The World's Jason Margolis has more from Houston.
Life was rough growing up for Jaime Fletcher in Houston. He moved from Columbia to Texas when he was 8 years old. Fletcher says when he got a little older, he got caught up in the gang life. Fast cars, guns, booze, and women.
One night that I was with a friend of mine who I'd grown up with, after leaving a club and drinking, we were sitting outside of his house. He looked at the liquor that he had in his hands and he said, I can't believe I'm still doing this. And I said, why? And he said, I can't believe I'm still doing this after having gone to Mecca. And I asked him, what is Mecca? And he said, it's where the house of God is. And that was strange for me. He said, Islam is a true religion of God. And I said, well, everybody says the religion is the truth.
Like most Latinos, Fletcher was raised in a Catholic family. But he says his parents also encouraged him to find his own truth. After briefly studying Christianity, Judaism, Taoism, and Buddhism, Fletcher came to believe that Islam was in fact the true religion of God. He converted and now goes by the name Mujahid Fletcher. He says Islam incorporated the family values he liked from Catholicism while getting rid of one big disadvantage.
Which was the aspect of the confession to a priest. Islam brings about a clear sense of asking for forgiveness or repentance directly to God without having an intermediary.
That holds great appeal for many Muslim converts, says Catherine Ewing, a professor of religion at Columbia University.
There are frustrations with the structure of the Catholic Church, the hierarchy. You know, numbers say that they're kind of bored with the Mass, that it doesn't seem related to their everyday needs.
She adds that Latinos aren't simply being pushed away by the Catholic Church. Many Latinos have been pulled toward Islam, especially post-September 11th. She says after the attacks and the immediate backlash against Muslims, Muslims began to reach out to outside communities to explain who they were. And many non-Muslims grew more curious about Islam.
They started to do internet research or to read the Quran to find out if it really advocated violence. And many, as they did that, actually saw Islam as a peaceful religion, as something that had more familiarity than they expected. They also found some of the beauty of the tradition as they explored further.
That's what Mujahid Fletcher found, and he wanted other Latinos to find this too. Problem, though, Islamic texts aren't easily accessible in Spanish. So Fletcher began doing translations and making audio recordings.
Bienvenidos a Islam in Spanish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. En el nombre de Dios, el más clemente, el más misericordioso.
Fletcher now runs a company called Islam in Spanish. He and his father, who also converted to Islam, have recorded more than 500 CDs and 200 cable access TV shows.
The end goal with Islam in Spanish is to educate Latinos about Islam worldwide.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
I visited Fletcher at his mosque in Sugarland, an affluent suburb of Houston. The large mosque looked like something you'd find in the Middle East or Turkey. There were about 100 people at the evening prayer the night I went. Fletcher counted himself as the only Latino. Fletcher said Latino Muslims are spread out in small pockets in big cities like Houston. I also met Daniel Abdullah Hernandez, a Puerto Rican convert who is now the imam at a mosque in the nearby city of Pearland. Hernandez was also a gang member when he was younger. He says finding Islam turned him into a responsible husband and father.
In the beginning, people think it's a phase. My mother, after 2 years of seeing my transformation, she became Muslim.
His father and brother did too. Together, they visited Egypt, a trip that cleared up any doubts they had about becoming Latino Muslims.
Me and my family were feeling that we were going to be lonely during the holidays. And that first year, we're sitting with other Hispanics, breaking bread and eating, and we were all amazed.
For most Latinos, though, Catholicism is more than just a religion. It can be about cultural identity. So while Islam or other religions may be replacing the Catholic religion for some Latinos, replacing the cultural connection to the Catholic Church, that could be much harder. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Houston, Texas.
The father of the modern assault rifle, Mikhail Kalashnikov, has died in Russia. He was 94. His AK-47 is so simple and so universal that Kalashnikov can arguably be considered one of the most influential people of the past several decades. The World's History Guy, Chris Wolfe, is here to tell us more about the Kalashnikov. And Chris, I hear you had an encounter with an AK-47.
Yeah, I never fired one. My experience was actually on the receiving end. I was in Afghanistan as a reporter during the last war, and we were on a UN truck, which was trying to get across the country in a bit of a hurry. And then this shepherd boy, who's like every other kid in Afghanistan, has an AK-47, decided he wanted a bribery to let us pass his little stretch of road. And our driver just ignored him. And so the kid just grabbed his AK and opened fire on the truck. It was only a single shot. No one got hurt. And we didn't give him any money. But I think it illustrates the bigger problem with the AK-47, which is that it is just so simple and so easy to use that a 12-year-old boy with no education in the mountains of Afghanistan is quite comfortable operating and using it. You don't need a lot of training. You don't need any mechanical skill. It's just so simple and reliable.
What is the basic design that makes it so effective?
It has very few moving parts. They don't really need much or any oil. You can throw it down, bury it in mud, pick it up out of the swamp, bury it in the sand for years, and it's still going to work as fine as it did on the day it came off the production line. Extraordinarily reliable, extraordinarily cheap, extraordinarily simple, and extraordinarily effective. You can always rely on it.
I don't even know what it looks like. Are we talking about a rifle, a gun? What is it?
It's a short rifle. If you see the classic curved magazine that gives it that classic look of that short, stubby kind of submachine gun-like
weapon. And the bullets come out over and over again.
Yeah, it's a 30-round magazine.
Now, the father of the Kalashnikov, Mikhail Kalashnikov, he died. He was 94. How long ago did he design this?
Well, the 47 in the AK-47 is the clue. He actually was a kid and then went into the Soviet army just before World War II and was wounded during a great battle at a place called Bryansk in Russia in 1941 when they were fighting the German invasion. And it was while he was convalescing that he first decided that, God, these Germans have such good weapons. We need something, you know, to defend the motherland with. And he started then in his mind tinkering with the idea of how to make a better weapon and tried to get into entering various competitions until he got approval to go ahead and then came up with this design around 1946, came into production in 1947, and, you know, general use with the Warsaw Pact and Soviet armies, you know, thereafter, and then after that all around the world. So, yes, the ubiquitousness came from in the 1970s when the Soviets decided to license all these other manufacturers around the world to make their own variants of it because it was so cheap and popular and reliable. So it's become this huge icon amongst particularly revolutionary style armies, to the extent that now it's embodied in the flag of Mozambique, the flag of Hezbollah. It's on the coats of arms of Zimbabwe and East Timor, and has this huge symbol of kind of like revolutionary power around the world.
Now, I read that Kalashnikov was one of 17 children, and he obviously created this during the Soviet era. How did he benefit or not from creating this?
Well, he never made a fortune. He donated the design to the state. He was a good socialist. And the Soviet state looked after him and has heaped him with honors, especially in more recent years when the Soviet Union became Russia. But he was never wealthy. He lived modestly in an industrial town east of Moscow. And there was a quote from him saying, "At that time in our country, patenting inventions wasn't an issue. We worked for socialist society, for the good of the people, which I never regret."
I wonder if Mikhail Kalashnikov ever had any regrets over his long life about having created the AK-47, given how it's been used in such a violent way.
He was well aware of how it was used, and reporters would often badger him with this very question. And his standard response was that, no, it's not my fault. It's the politicians who have, you know, used it for ill and taken advantage of it. He said in an interview in 2007, "I sleep very well." However, he also has said that you can blame the Nazis for him coming up with a good gun design. He would have preferred to make agricultural machinery. And he said, "I always wanted to work on a good lawnmower."
Chris Wolfe, the World's History Guy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. You know it's the holidays when people start pouring rum into their eggnog. But rum drinkers, beware. Not all versions of the stuff are created equal. You have your industrial variety rum, made from molasses by brand giants like Bacardi or Captain Morgan. But if you want the really good stuff, check the version that's spelled R-H-U-M, as in rum agricole. The best varieties come from the French Caribbean island of Martinique. Wyatt Peabody devoted a whole article to rum agricole for the online drinks magazine Punch.
What we think of as rum today is not really reflective of what it can be.
So what can it be?
It can be pretty spectacular. And it's just the purest expression of rum that you can possibly find. You know, as opposed to 99% of the world's rum, which is made from molasses, which was actually a byproduct of sugar manufacturing that goes back centuries, rum agricole is made from fresh-pressed sugarcane juice, and it makes for an entirely different expression, the likes of which no one has experienced if they've not had rum agricole.
So can you tell us what the difference is in taste?
One of the easiest ways to do it is make a simple daiquiri with white rum from Puerto Rico, say, and compare that with a daiquiri made from rum agricole, and you'll get something in that white distillate that is like nothing else on earth in terms of reflecting terroir and sense of place. You get a funk, which for those of us in this business, we love that word. We love sherry. We love mezcal. We love rum agricole because it's got funk to it. A sense of place, a sense of the earth. Herbaceousness, dampness, reflective of the microclimates.
So when you say terroir, you mean where it was made and therefore how it tastes?
Correct.
Okay.
Of its very specific soils. Mm-hmm. The chalky soils of cognac come through in the ultimate distillate.
Is it penetrating the U.S. market much?
The growth has been really explosive, and I'm really proud to see it, quite frankly. Again, we're talking about an industry that's dominated by one brand or a handful of brands that kind of, through marketing and smart campaigns, shift the public opinion. And this Martinique thing, it's the underdog for sure. Rum agricole is roughly 1% to 2% of global production of rum in total. So it's definitely the little dog in the fight. I can't give you numbers, but I can just tell you that I travel a great deal around the United States, and I've seen an incredible explosion in the rum agricole business domestically.
Is it mostly in restaurants and bars as opposed to in stores in the U.S.?
Yes. The on-premise consumed in bars and restaurants is obviously explosive. That's where the tastemakers are. Those people are actually going down to Martinique, and they're getting to experience what it's like to be there, some of them.
And is it all part of the sort of trend toward artisanal, local, perfect kind of stuff?
Very, very much reflective of that. You know, people are more and more wanting to taste the best possible expression and the artisan expression as opposed to some industrial mutation. And with that quest, rum agriculture is a natural fit right now, what's happening. I mean, you know, keep in mind, this is the only appellation, the AOC, Appellation Origine Contrôlée, outside of France in the world.
So let's get down to the nitty-gritty. What about cost compared to the rum we know?
Well, you know, it's definitely more expensive than – well, I mean, you know, it's hard to say with the rum we know because there are so many different expressions of rum. You might be paying a little bit more, but I would argue that what you get for that dollar is tremendously more than you can get from molasses-based rum in most cases. Absolutely no comparison with what you get from rum agricole.
So you're always moving around looking for the latest thing that tastes good. How did you stumble upon the rum agricole?
I spent a lot of time working with mezcal. And, you know, the terroir reflective nature of mezcal was something that was always important to me. And I guess that I just found rum agricole before it was really coming into the United States. I mean, keep in mind, this wasn't really coming here until 2005 or 6. And it was just, you know, it was a natural expression. People sharing bottles, smuggling bottles. And it was one of these beautiful things that just evolved. And now, of course, everyone's talking about it. And keep in mind that this stuff has been selling very happily in France and the rest of Europe for some time. We are slow to the game here in the United States. We're catching up, if you will. And, you know, the people are really charged to know that their neighbors to the north, as opposed to shipping stuff across the ocean, that we're excited about it. And again, a lot of people are making pilgrimages down there, whether bartenders or chefs or consumers. And, you know, it's one of the most spectacular trips you can take. It's not easy to get there, but once you do, it's like nothing else I've experienced in the Caribbean, that's for sure.
Wyatt Peabody. He's written about rum agricole for the online drinks magazine Punch. Thanks so much, Wyatt.
Thank you.
And finally today, one more best of 2013 musical suggestions from one of our DJ friends from around the globe. This one comes to us from pretty close to the North Pole.
Hey there, this is Marius Asp from NRK Norway. My favorite album this year comes from the British duo Disclosure, consisting of brothers Guy and Howard Lawrence, 22 and 19 years old respectively. Their debut album, titled Settle, is undoubtedly one of the most confident, soulful and realized club records in a decade, at the very least. Of course, the boundaries between electronic, indie and pop music have long since been erased, and never more so than in 2013. With Settle, Disclosure has made an album reflecting just that. It's playful and extroverted enough to top the UK charts, and still sonically detailed and challenging enough to win over the growing number of techno, house and dubstep diehards over the world. The guest list is impressive. Aluna George, Jamie Woon, and Jesse Ware are among the rising stars lending their voices to this project. But even more importantly, the songs are great. Hooky, restless, bubbling, and energetic. All in all, Disclosure's Settle comes highly recommended, both for fans of clubbing and people like myself, who prefer internal dancing in the living room at home. Regardless of any genre, it's my favorite album this year.
Again, the CD is called Settle from the British duo Disclosure. It's the best release of the year, according to Marius Asp of Station NRK in Oslo, Norway. Check out his other favorites for 2013, plus picks from all of our DJ contributors at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We'll be back tomorrow. Carefully, we will come through.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems, at skoll.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.